self-hosted shows back again, and it's been too long since our buddy Brent was here, Alex, and I know you were just hanging out with him, so you thought it'd be a good time to bring him back. Welcome, Brent. It's been too long.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I don't even really remember the last time. Was I at... No, I wasn't at Alex's. Anyways, a while.
I think it was July. Yeah, it's been a hot minute. But since then, I have been introduced to the magic of Boots In. How did I do? How did I do?
Is it Boots In? Or is it Booze In?
So I've been attempting to teach Alex the Canadian ways, the French Canadian ways of saying Poutine specifically, because
Poutine.
Most people get it wrong. So I gave him a trick, you know? It's kind of like saying Boots In, but you got to flip the B.
Now I regret asking.
Yeah, it's just he's getting there.
So for those that aren't learned and scholars of the Canadian culinary delicacy that is poutine, it's chips, French fries, and gravy with cheese curds. If you're British, so I had two or three poutines whilst I was up there, and one of them had like this Bisto gravy on it, and it was really beefy and strong, and it was fine. And then the next one I had was this beautiful, delicate, like chicken gravy on it that was actually pretty nice. And then the other one was just like a, you know, cheap airport one that was not good at all.
Soybean oil.
It's weird that the Canadians view this as a delicacy to me, though, because I mean, it's just chips and gravy, isn't it? That's what you get when you piss down the kebab house.
And it sounds like one of those things is good for 5 minutes, but 15 minutes in, it's just a soggy mess.
Wait. You're missing a third of the, like, essential ingredients, Alex. You said chips and gravy, but necessarily each of these had to have cheese curds as well. That makes the whole trio.
I guess I still have a way to go with my poutine relationship, don't I?
Clumps of soggy cheese, you gotta have that.
Chris, come on, give it a chance. But you did also have butter tarts, right? How did those do?
Oh, yes. So listeners, let me paint you a picture. I arrived in Calgary Airport. I came out of the immigration area, and Brent was there to meet me at the sign. After some tribulations and trials with the rental car situation, which we talked about in the recent Linux Unplugged, by the way, I got to my hotel room, and Brent was excited about something. And I'm like, what's waiting for me behind this door? Thinking maybe a clown was going to jump out or something. No. The sweetheart Brent had filled my minibar fridge with a couple of bottles of Diet Coke and some orange juice, because he knows that of an evening, typically I have an orange juice, but also waiting for me were some English-style scones and some Canadian butter tarts.
A delectable, you know, spread. You choose. You probably shouldn't have any of them before bed, but whatever. I can't control you.
At the end of a long day on airplanes, let me tell you, that was a treat for the eyes and the constitution. So thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Now, whenever you guys get together, it's not just about the food. There's often a lot of gear involved, some tech exchanging happening. And Brent, I know that you got some new to you gear. You've got some gear that's been around for a little bit. And we thought, since it's been so long since we got to catch up with you, let's see what you've got in your home lab these days.
Yeah, I got to say, guys, like my digital lab seems to change every couple of weeks. I don't even recognize it anymore. Alex, you brought over this little 1 liter PC. I didn't even know this was going to happen. You just sort of pulled it out of your bag and you said, here you go. This was part of your collection, but it was also passed down to you from Fuzzy Mistborn, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, so that box started life in Pennsylvania, and now it's come down to Raleigh for a bit, had a nice summer vacation, and now it's going to go and live up in the frozen tundra with you.
Well-traveled computers. And so I don't know why I've sort of fallen in love with this thing. It's an HP Pro desk, and I kind of love it already, but I haven't even thrown a workload at it yet. It's just such a beautiful size, and it just sort of hums. And Alex, you were showing me, you know, to take the case apart, it's just this beautiful thumb screw, and you pull it apart, and it's just really well designed. I'm very impressed. And so I'm excited for this to be part of my life for a while. I need recommendations on what I can throw at the thing. I guess it has QuickSync and a whole bunch of other options. So,
well, being a fourth gen Intel CPU, it's very, very early days in the QuickSync train. So I'll put a link in the description or the show notes of the different codecs that all the different QuickSync, you know, all the different Intel CPU generations support of QuickSync. So you do start to get the benefit of QuickSync on these early ones, but it's only once you get to about sixth gen that things start to get really interesting in that space. So, you know, for me, the fourth gen is, I mean, it's useful for things like OpenSense maybe as a router. For you, I mean, it's going to be great just for you to experiment with things like Proxmox, I would have thought.
Ooh.
Throw some VMs around, some LXC containers, all that kind of stuff. You know, because, you know, for Linux Unplugged, you're always testing out new distros.
I almost threw Windows on it the other day, but decided instead to throw it on my framework. Now, the framework, Nextcloud, was kind enough to allow me to do this crazy non-standard thing and buy, you know, kind of a cool laptop. They bought it for me, which is amazing. And so I threw Windows on there as an experiment. It won't be like that long term.
So which CPU did you go through on the framework?
Well, you see, I, of course, had to not do it in a standard way. So I teamed up with a listener, Tomash, who's based in Berlin, had the thing shipped to him, and he is a early framework adopter. So he's had a framework for a long time, 11th gen. And so I guess I got the 14th gen that I ordered, but I don't actually need that performance necessarily. So I decided to do a swap with him. He paid the little extra on the bill that it required to do the upgrade. He wanted to do an upgrade, but didn't quite, you know, have all the cash to do so and didn't know what to do with the old motherboard. So this was a cool way for me to use his old motherboard, but in the new chassis and with a new monitor and stuff. So it's, you know, that is kind of only possible with a framework.
How's the fan noise and stuff, Brent?
You know, I noticed it for the very first time. It became annoying to me when I was installing Windows, which says a lot.
It's a sign.
And occasionally, just when Windows was just sitting there doing nothing. I haven't really played with Windows. We're just giving it a test for Linux Unplugged. And yeah, occasionally it just, like, especially when Windows is just sitting there doing nothing, all of a sudden the fans would go up like crazy. Like, literally, it was a fresh install. I hadn't even touched it. It was just sitting there doing nothing. And all the updates were done. But that was really the only time I've seen them accelerate in a way that was actually quite loud. I know a lot of people have complained about them. I have not had enough time on the framework to really give it its good paces. But when I had NixOS on there, it was much, much better in that regard. So I don't know if that's just, I don't know. It's just Windows to me. But
I could see the installer pushing it. And then there's probably a lot of background tasks when there's a fresh install.
Yeah, you know, and of course, as soon as I would go and try to investigate, everything would quiet down. So I feel like almost they're notice, you know, they're doing some background stuff. And as soon as the user does anything, it kind of goes away quietly. So, I mean, that's just me making stuff up. But
I'm looking at your setup from afar, Brent. And, you know, you've got some nice gear now. I mean, it's older gear, but it's going to be great for, like, home lab stuff. You got that Starlink. And it just, like, it hasn't clicked yet. But I feel like there's going to be a... You're going to find a total overhaul at some point when you realize, okay, I've got a good high speed connection that's always on, and that really clicks. And if I move, I can even take it with me. And you've got that HP leader, you know, that little 1 liter machine now. You could set yourself up a really nice little Jellyfin Nextcloud system that all runs locally, but like using something like Tailscale or Zero Tier or Nebula, you could still get all those resources at a pretty good reliable connection now with that Starlink. Like, I feel like a revolution's gonna come in your way.
I think you're so right. That was never in the realm of possibility for me because I knew it was just, you know, the internet connection was the worst part of the whole thing. So I almost treated my local network as though it was offline, except for essentials.
That's what I did when I was on LTE.
Yeah. So you've gone through this transition as well.
Yeah.
So it's curious to me. I'm almost having to shift my expectations of what's possible here in my little cabin in the woods, which is actually really cool. And it makes me think about how hanging out with you two boys, and I've just been behind on all the tech because I, you know, there's just like, if you're not connected to the internet, then what the hell?
The first time I streamed a Jellyfin video from my RV while I was out on the go from my phone, it blew my mind, right? Because I used to be able to barely even stream videos to the TV in the RV, let alone like play my media library from the RV on the go. And yeah, and, you know, you just combine it with a server and the connection and Tailscale or something like that. You're off to the races, Brent. I'm really looking forward to seeing what you build over time. No pressure.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I'm sure I'll come back and report. But, yeah, Proxmox, Alex, as you mentioned, is in well, it's right at the top of the list of the things I'm, you know, the enablers. But of course, with that comes a bunch of like fancy DNS stuff. And I don't know. We'll see.
Well, while you're down here for Linux Fest, we might do some Proxmox installations. So you might get a little experience.
Ooh, on a couple servers we have there, I'm sure. Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I'm in.
And Alex, I know you got some new gear as well. And this is new gear.
I mean, literally this week, dear listeners, I threw a pint of water over my work laptop. So whilst I was in Canada, Apple repaired it. So I've had a brand new laptop. iPhone 15 turned up. So a new laptop, new phone. I've got a Apple Watch too, which is brand new. So like, it's just, there's a lot of new stuff going on. And so when Chris says there's something new, my brain goes, well, how does he know about those? But what he's actually talking about is something that showed up today. We talked about it a little bit last episode. It's a PoE Zigbee radio from Tubes ZB. And this thing arrived today. It is, you know, a bit bigger than an ESP32, but not much. I haven't had a chance to plug it in because it really literally only arrived a couple of hours before we pressed record today. But the idea behind this thing is I'll be able to put it anywhere in my house where there's Ethernet, you know, so I can put it where the signal is going to be most advantageous to me. And then it will connect back over auto discovery to ZHA as part of Home Assistant. The developer does not recommend Zigbee to MQTT. He marks it as experimental and not recommended or supported. So I mentioned Zigbee to MQTT last episode. I guess I won't be doing that. I guess I'll be sticking with ZHA. But the smart blinds that I put up whilst I've been away have not been reliable according to wife, hence why I ordered this thing. Next episode, I will be digging into this for you. But for now, it's arrived and we can look forward to that.
Sorry to have such a stupid question, but you're telling me the ZHA integration on Home Assistant can detect this thing over Ethernet? So it's like also scanning the IP network?
Apparently so, yeah. I mean, I haven't actually done it yet, but it does say it ships with this, you know, flashcard-sized piece of paper that just says ZHA setup, auto discovery, or manual setup available at this socket IP address.
Man, cool. That's really neat. I'll be curious. And it's under $80, so if it solves your problem, that seems well worth it. I think another thing, if you haven't done it already, is put a Zigbee smart plug in that room too, because all the smart plugs will generally be repeaters. And that's been my kind of go-to solution to patching my Zigbee network is, if it's a little weak, smart plug in that area.
That's true, yeah. What I'm wondering is, if I was to want to migrate slowly and keep all of my Hue lights and things that are actually bulletproof reliable on the existing Conbee-based Zigbee network and then set this up as a second ZHA instance within the same Home Assistant, I wonder, can I do that?
I'm almost virtually positive that it has support for multiple controllers.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, if that's the case, then I'll migrate a few devices at a time and hopefully my blinds will work.
You know what? I'm pretty confident you're going to get it probably nailed at just in time for Matter to really take off.
Well, that's the nice thing about this thing is it's upgradable to Thread and Matter in the future too.
So, oh, that's cool. Yeah.
It's as future-proof as anything in this space can be.
Right. Really. Even though I've had more success with Z-Wave, this is kind of why I've slid over time slowly to the Zigbee camp because it's kind of where things are going.
Wasn't Matter supposed to be out by now? Like, wasn't it supposed to be mainstream by now?
I think there are some. No, I think there are some. I mean, they're always talking about various Matter devices in the Home Assistant release streams, so they're out there. Maybe they're just all on Alibaba.
Well, speaking about these little 1-liter PCs, in the interests of covering the news you all might be interested in listening to this show, even though I now have discovered the ways of these 1-liter PCs, and I couldn't really care less about the Raspberry Pi anymore, the Raspberry Pi 5 has been announced. Hooray!
Yay! Huzzah! And if you get a hat, you do get some PCI storage, so that's pretty good to see. I mean, storage is my number one criticism. It's still, though, out-of-the-box SD card-based for primary storage.
Okay, there are a lot of cool things on the Raspberry Pi 5, which we should probably talk about at least a little bit. PCIe support is here, although you do have to use a dongle to access the PCI bridge that's there. It's out of the box, I think, PCIe version 2, but you can set a developer flag or a debug flag to set it to full PCIe 3 interface speeds, so that's nice. It has a power button.
Yes. And a real-time clock. I mean, those combined, we're talking some serious improvements here.
I know. It's almost like it's a real computer now, eh?
I guess it kind of is. I mean, I am legitimately looking forward to trying it. I was a little late on the pre-order because I was on the fence, and they're already, like, at most places, TBD on the shipping.
Yeah. So, look, I mean, I know I give the Raspberry Pi a hard time, but the reason is because, you know, if you look on eBay right now, I guarantee you, you will find a 1 liter PC like the one I gave Brent, but a 6th, 7th, 8th gen Intel x86 full CPU with a full SATA port and maybe even an M.2 slot.
And potentially QuickSync.
Yeah, for maybe $100 or less.
Yeah.
Now, where the Pi makes sense is use cases that require the GPIO. That's still a killer use case for the Pi. Also, the whole appliance aspect, I'm not completely an idiot. Like, I'm still open to the, you know, the fact that this was great to throw in as part of a 3D printer setup or something like that. It's small. Okay, this one's probably going to need active cooling because it, I think the power supply they ship with it now is like 25 watts or something, which is, you know, you're going to need a serious amount of cooling to do that passively. And it doesn't ship with a heat sink on the CPU, so...
If the case manufacturers come up with something for like a home media PC, I could see folks in our audience picking up the Pi 5 or maybe now a cheaper Pi 4 and making a little Kodi box out of that, you know, gluing it to the back of your TV. I could still see it do those kinds of features. Although I think they dropped H.264 hardware decoding. So I don't know. But I think it would still make a pretty good Kodi box.
I'm curious how you boys both feel about the timing. Do you think a Raspberry Pi 5 a year ago would have had you more excited? Do you think this is a little too late?
Yes. Yes.
Yes, I think so. A Raspberry Pi 5 with an M.2 slot on the back would have had me even more excited.
Or 32 gigabytes of eMMC storage.
When you look at the performance of competitors like the Rockchip-based stuff, the Pi is just, it's in this really difficult adolescent phase where it's, you know, during COVID and supply chain issues and all that, like you couldn't buy them. We all know this by now. And during that period, the 1 liter PC revolution, all those things started to come off their 3, 4, 5 year long leases. I guess as people started working from home as well, that probably contributed to more of them being available. And now you can get such a high level of performance from a 5 year old x86 computer. You know, you think about when the Pi 1 came out. What was an x86 chip of 5 years previous like? It was probably
like a Core 2 Duo.
Yeah. Pulling 100 watts of power.
And that was a totally different equation.
Right.
Whereas now, it just feels to me like it, I don't really know, unless you need the GPIO, I don't really know who it's for.
Yeah. Anymore. You know, I used to make the argument on this show it was low power because I was in a battery situation, solar situation, but the Intel, you know, CPUs have been solving that for years, and that work has paid off.
Yeah.
You know, what I could see getting excited about is a CM5. You know, the speed, performance, the PCI support, something that you put into a daughter board that has the SATA ports and everything you actually need. A CM5 could be a pretty cool, at least core, to build things like maybe the next home assistant device around or something.
Maybe I'm missing the point here. And listeners, if you have strong opinions about why I'm missing the point, please, please write in and tell me why I'm wrong. I would genuinely love to hear that. But Chris is right. You know, you look at the power consumption here. It's not 25. It's 27 watts. I got it wrong. You know, that's a, you know, the box I sent you, Brent, at peak load is doing 40 watts. But I'd love to see like a Geekbench comparison of that. See, even a fourth gen Intel CPU versus this thing. I suspect the Intel would probably still win.
Not to mention flexibility around packaging and stuff. Like ARM packages are still kind of lagging behind, right? It's been years, but
yeah,
not everything's
assuming
on there.
You can even buy a Raspberry Pi 5 in a timely fashion too. Now, there are some really interesting hats available. You can get a PoE hat for it. An M.2 hat is also available. I believe these hats are all stackable as well. So if you want to do all these things at once, you can do that too. There will be some heat and thermal considerations if you stack multiple hats together. So bear that in mind.
You need a hat rack.
Yeah, these Pi 5 cases are going to be getting weird, man. Trying to accommodate all these hats. You're going to cut all the, yeah, you probably, you know what? Brent, somebody is going to create a a hat rack. Yeah, that's going to be a thing.
I mean, it's a good product name.
And it's a hat rack for a bunch of hats.
Heck yeah.
I agree with you, though, Chris. You know, when we can get a Touring Pi with the CM5, I mean, we're looking at like a 2.5x lift in performance on the CPU between the Raspberry Pi 4 and the 5. So, I mean, I've had a Raspberry Pi 4 tucked into my Prusa behind me for the last 4 years at this point. So I'm kind of used to how slow that feels now. If I was just to straight up throw a 5 in there, I'm gonna notice that difference. So I might still pick one up for my 3D printer, just to be a complete hypocrite. But
yeah, I think I'm going to try to get one too. I mean, I want to be fair to it.
Yeah.
And you know, I feel like I should, I think I've mentioned this, but you know, I'm still using a couple of Pis actually. My Pi hole actually runs on a Raspberry Pi using USB storage. And I have a Shinobi Pi that I turn on when I'm going to be gone for a while. So it's mostly off, but then I have a little smart switch that turns it on if I'm going to be absent. And that still is on a Pi as well, just mostly because it works and those are not super demanding jobs. Like the Shinobi's monitoring two cameras and the Pi hole is, you know, everything's pretty much running out of RAM. And for those jobs, they just, I'm going to run them until they die, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. What do you think of the new pricing structure? So you can buy a 4 gigabyte variant for $60
yeah.
or an 8 gigabyte variant for $80. So it's a $5 uplift from the last version.
I guess it's okay. I mean, you do get more for it. And it sounds like from the technical analysis that I've read is that the board is capable of 16 gigs of RAM. So maybe next year at some point we see another, you know, $95 unit or something that comes with 16 gigs of RAM.
Could we not put an SODIMM slot on this thing?
Oh,
imagine that. That'd be nice. Well, it's a new month, October, so that means there's a new Home Assistant release come out. There was a couple of nice UI updates I saw come through today.
Yeah, I think I'm actually going to remove my custom hacks installed thermostat thing that's kind of like a ripoff of the Nest. I think I'm going to use their built-in one now. It's looking really good, and they've just improved the UI in a few other places as well. It's not a huge update. Not a huge update because I know they're holding stuff for their voice announcement coming up soon. But a nice solid one. And they made a good improvement for those ESP Home users out there. There was a bug, I guess you could call it, in where they were saving some of the build logs. And it was getting backed up. And that doubled the size of the ESP Home backups. And so they've taken that log file out. It doesn't need to be in there. It only needs to be in there for the build time when you're, you know, like say doing an update. They've removed that from the backup, and it cuts the ESP Home backups now in half, their file size in half. So that's great to see.
That's really nice.
Yeah, yeah. There's some of the good things in there. You know, it's not one I'd say you have to rush out to update, but I think if you're comfortable updating fairly soon after release, because there isn't any major, major changes, it's a pretty safe one to jump on. I already updated my studio unit this morning.
Now, there was a particularly cool ESP Home release feature came through this month. Did you know you can now compile an ESP Home firmware with native WireGuard support in it?
Wow, that could be really cool for edge devices or all kinds of things. Wow.
I'm just imagining something like, I don't know, in your garden, for example, that let's say is only available via a cheap cellular modem or something, and you want to monitor this stuff. We were trying to strategize a way for you to get that data back to the mothership, weren't we?
Yeah, even when I'm going down the road, right? We were going along building something, and it dawned on me, well, wait a minute. When the RV pulls out of the driveway, all of these sensors stop talking. Mm-hmm. And then it was, you know, kind of getting complicated pretty quick. But yeah, Alex, man, if you had like a Wi-Fi access point on a cheap cellular, because, I mean, not much data, right? On a cheap cellular, a little yep. Wi-Fi device. And then these things are connecting back over WireGuard all the time regardless. Oh, man.
I mean, I'm just imagining the possibilities of having those, you know, $3, $4, $5 ESP boards available to talk to, as long as there's an internet available, talk back to your Home Assistant. Imagine all the extra sensors you can have.
Heck yeah.
It's going to be pretty cool.
And the data's protected by WireGuard. Well, I'll keep an eye on that.
Do you remember just a few years ago we didn't have WireGuard?
I watched it from the early days. It felt like it took forever to come to fruition.
Well, all the things you really are excited about do, right? But it just has been such an enabler of all sorts of really, really fascinating solutions and technologies. It's great.
So I finally did the right thing and ignored everyone's advice and installed Spook. Have you heard of Spook? Does this ring a bell at all to you, Alex?
No. When you put this in the doc, I must admit I had to go and read up what it was.
So it's made by one of the core developers, Frank, and he totally doesn't recommend. Don't use it. Do not use this. It's not meant for your average Home Assistant user.
Perfect.
I think they oversell the danger of it. It extends Home Assistant functionality, and it adds a few extra features to devices and entities, including Home Assistant Cloud itself. You can now toggle more options for Home Assistant Cloud. And it gives you a couple of nice little ways to edit entities. But one thing it does that this is why I installed it. It kind of walks through your Home Assistant config and surfaces any problems with entities or devices that aren't connected correctly or aren't working correctly that maybe you don't know about that are in some sort of error state and puts them into your notifications. So you can actually go take action and resolve the problem. And it can rate how serious the problem is and kind of give you a little bit of error output so you can kind of troubleshoot it a little bit. There's other really nice things it does, but that to me was the big one, is to kind of have Spook go through and find these, because I knew I'd had a couple from the holiday devices that I'd set up, but then I didn't properly remove them. So Spook found them, identified them, and I was able to resolve the issue in like 30 seconds.
That's pretty cool. I mean, there was a point where some of that self-diagnosis stuff got a little bit spammy. I think they've turned that back down a little bit. Do you find that's the case with this?
So far, it's only been that one thing that I kind of was prepared for. Otherwise, it really hasn't bothered me at all. It does have a couple of nice other enhanced features. Like you can, when you're editing automations, it can add a couple of extra fields and it just things that kind of like I wish Home Assistant had anyways, but I think they just keep out because they don't want to add too many buttons and fields for people because they're trying to keep it clean. And this puts some of that back in too.
I always wonder how, you know, when people talk about keeping Home Assistant clean, like, I'm not giving it to my mom anyway.
So one day, maybe.
Just make it a power user thing and let me be happy.
You know, though, there is a space because there are so many homes, and I see this all over the RV industry, where you come into the home or the RV and they've got these touch screens that are pre-installed in the wall now, and they're all using this entirely proprietary automation system. And in the case of the RVs, it's like it even controls your slides, and it's just a monster to deal with, and the systems burn out and they're very expensive. And I look at these and I think maybe one day, way down the road, Home Assistant would just be the platform these things are built on. Like in the early days, we would build our own operating systems for every little device. Like if you got a home cable box, it had some custom OS on there. And then as the years went on, everybody just started using Linux and they just built their own thing on top of Linux. And maybe that could happen with Home Assistant. Then we'd at least have some standards and some, you know, local control and things like that. That's my long-term hope for where Home Assistant could go, for like at least in homes. Like when you see these proprietary home automation systems that are built into houses or these RVs, it's like they're stuck there forever. You can never change that. And it's like, the house could last 100 years, and that system's, after 5 years, probably abandoned.
That is the promise of Home Assistant, hey? You know? I think there are probably huge business opportunities that are yet to be tapped using Home Assistant for small to medium MSP companies to go around and manage not only residential properties, but also commercial
offices.
Properties, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, Alex, what are we doing? Let's get a side gig going. You could do the East Coast installs. I'll do the West Coast installs. We got a business right here.
And I would imagine, because a lot of those proprietary automation systems have insane markups, you could probably still undercut them by half and still make a huge amount of money.
Well, and you could also, if they wanted, offer networking solutions, internet connectivity solutions, VPN solutions. Just
I'm talking in hypotheticals here, but I talk regularly with one of our listeners who does exactly that for a bunch of people near your hometown, Brent, Sudbury, not too far.
What, really?
So if somebody listening is in the business, you got to call me. I'll go work for you. That sounds like a blast.
You'd have to move to Canada though and eat poutine all day.
No, I'm not. Well, I'll try the poutine. But
he said poutine. Now he's regressed. Jeez.
Oh yeah, right. The Putin. I'll eat the Putin. I think I'll stick with poutine. Thanks.
Can we change the subject, please? Can
yes.
we keep some decorum in here?
Yes. Back to the technology.
Good. Now, Brent, I want to talk a little bit about your brother's TV setup. I don't know how comfortable you are at me explaining your residential situation, but you live, ostensibly, you live with your brother, right?
I live about 112 feet away.
In a place more beautiful than Narnia, in cabins that are so ridiculously quintessentially adorable, you could just picture it. You can just picture it in your mind. Yeah.
It's the truth. So to paint a picture, we were having dinner one night and there was just a herd of elk in the meadow down below Brent's cabin. It's so beautiful. I can't even, pictures do not do it justice. You just have to see it with your eyes. However, we got talking technology with your brother for a little
you?
Bit.
Weird.
I know. And we were watching TV for a while and it dawned on me that the thing powering the TV was a ThinkPad. Tell us about that, Brent.
I love this ThinkPad, and it's a collection of ThinkPads that I found at the landfill, of all places.
Really? Really?
Yeah, when I lived up in Sudbury, Northern Ontario.
Somebody threw it away, and it's ticking away today as a media machine?
That's what I'm saying. So they had electronics recycling, like a shipping container is exactly what it was. And I, you know, as a lover of all tech, would just walk in there. Like every time I went, which is surprisingly often, I would just walk into this like giant shipping container and just see what's in there. And one day there was this load of like old ThinkPads. And so there was some like T60s and stuff like that. But one of them was a T440. And, you know, that's like far less old than a T60. And the only thing broken on it, from what I could tell, walking into the shipping container where it clearly says, you know, do not remove anything from here, it seemed like just the screen was broken and it was missing a hard drive. So I was like, I think that might have a future in my life. So I grabbed this thing and sure enough, got home, booted it up, and it worked. And the only thing that didn't work was the monitor on it, which, as we know, Alex, you and I have loads of experience replacing these monitors. It's really easy to do. But when I moved here with my brother, he didn't really have a good solution. Actually, he had a laptop running his television, but it was like 20 years old, like this ancient, ancient thing that could hardly even play videos. So it's like, hey, I got this like old laptop I found in a rubbish bin. You want this thing? So it has since, for a couple years now, been running their media center. The monitor is still broken because you don't even need it for that. And it's just sitting there ticking away. And for the most part, it's been just perfect.
Are they doing VLC? Are they doing Kodi? Like what's the, are they just like launching files from Explorer or the file manager?
Yeah, I think its biggest use is streaming stuff from a web browser. So
they got like a little remote keyboard.
You know,
oh, no, it's better than that. Okay. It's better than that. So I sit down on the couch. I sit down on the couch and I'm like, okay, there is a screen in front of me. I recognize KDE. How do I control this thing? And both of the brothers look at me like I'm an idiot and say, KDE Connect, of course. And I'm like, but I'm on iOS. I can't do that. And they go, are you sure? So I look in the App Store and lo and behold,
sure enough,
there is a KDE Connect in the iOS App Store, which I did not know. So you load up KDE Connect, it auto discovers the laptop, which is just, you know, the MDNS working there is just, you know, mind blowing to me. And then I'm able to control it, like using the trackpad with my thumb on the screen as if it's a mouse and type on a keyboard and send my clipboard when I had to log into F1 TV and all this stuff, you know. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And it's got a real web browser, so you can actually log into that stuff and use it.
Exactly.
Yeah, when it comes around holiday time, we do like family video calls off this thing too, and we don't even move it. We just like angle it slightly, and we just all sit on the couches and stuff, and we have this massive big screen of my parents. It's amazing. So it's multi-use, and Alex, I think it works, right?
Well, you say that, but when I was there, it had a bit of a paddy, had a bit of a meltdown, didn't it?
Yeah, I don't know what it was, but something caused the CPU to just get pinned at 100 to the point where I couldn't even log in on the terminal, like, you know, doing like an Alt F1 or whatever to get to like.
And then we tried to reboot it and it just hung. You know how like systemd sometimes just won't let go of a process and the only way to kill it is to actually hard press the button. Yeah. So whatever it was doing, it was not a happy bunny. But I'm reliably informed, normally, when I'm not there, it's very reliable, don't you know?
Well, I got a note from my brother, you know, I just had about Netflix time last night. And he was like, hey, Did you touch the media center? It's not working again. So, Alex, I don't know what you did.
Uh-oh.
The media center. Adorable. I mean, like, how have you not just been a little tempted to put Kodi on there? Because it's got like a 10-foot interface, you know, or
well,
something.
The challenge with Kodi is that I put that system in thinking that I could also do a bunch of other cool stuff with it. So my brother and his wife's backup system, as you might imagine with most people, is just abysmal. He knows better and even bought a drive. And I've been trying to convince him, you know, to plug that thing in. So I was seeing this adorable media center as sort of a multi-purpose device. You know, it could run their TV, but it could just be also be sitting there doing silent backups of their devices and things like that. And so that hasn't materialized just yet, but that's the intention. So if you've, you know, only got Kodi thrown on that thing, then it might limit that a little bit, but I'm open to other solutions that might be better.
Maybe Raspberry Pi 5.
No, now you're talking.
There was a period of time, I mean, a long, long, long period of time where I had a full PC hooked up. I mean, I did use different media center UIs. And I inevitably would get like an IR remote for them. And, you know, you can really take it all the way if you want. You can get a real TV-like experience.
You mean Windows Media Center back in the day, did you?
I tried it for a hot minute.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Myth TV, for sure. And then there was like something called Media Center PC or something like that I tried for a while. And then a Boxy. I tried the Boxy box for a bit, which
yep.
It's been a long time.
You know, I think at the crux of most of the computers in my life, or at least my attempts at some kind of fancy infrastructure, is I always kind of want to give the longest life possible to some of these systems. You know, they're there, especially the ThinkPads. They just kind of seem to just go forever. And so, yeah, okay, maybe it isn't good for other things, but as a media center, like, it just keeps going and going and going. It's like the Energizer Bunny. So I feel like it's just doesn't really make sense to replace it. It's, yeah, okay, it's probably sipping a bit more power than a modern system, but really, it's doing exactly what it needs to. And it, I don't know, no reason to replace it, I think.
Digging into the archives a little bit, if you'd like to hear Chris and I's journey to the NVIDIA Shield, episode 23, we talked about our history with the Boxy Box and the Xbox Media Center on an actual Xbox back in the day.
Oh, yeah, and the Popcorn Hour was in that episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a good one, I think. But Brent, I really admire your just general approach to hardware, just keeping stuff going for far longer than I think I could personally be bothered to do so, because I watched you a few times whilst we were there tinkering with stuff. And I'm like, if this was a newer device, this entire problem wouldn't be happening. And it's just a question of, you know, personal values, number one. You know, you and your brother have this don't buy anything new rule, which I think is totally cool. But then there is a time cost associated with that of tinkering with this old gear, as well as a reliability cost that is, you know, tied to the time situation. And I just find it really fascinating how you get the most out of these devices for many, many, many years. And I think you should be applauded for that.
Yeah, you're right. It does come with issues, right? I've run into multiple strange issues because of hardware, like that X220 I've got in my cabin here that is kind of my own server system that's been doing backups and things for me. All of a sudden, it just has started turning off, almost like a thermal protection thing. And yeah, Chris is going to say cat hair is probably to blame, but and you might be onto something there.
Almost definitely, yeah.
But yeah, these problems, I don't know, I guess that's the cost of having the ideals that I do. And maybe I'm just sort of, you know, tying one arm behind my back, trying to, you know, do the right thing.
Well, I've genuinely thought the same thing is true with you. And sometimes your obsession with sticking with Linux in general, you know, there's a big difference between you and I and how we approach things in the world. I tend to have a bit more of a pragmatic approach. Like, I just need to get this done. Okay. That means I've got to use a Mac today. And I'll just get on with it and use the Mac. Whereas I know you would spend 6 hours trying to make it work on the Linux equivalent and then probably still get the job done, but it just takes a bit longer. And it's just a really interesting, whenever you see someone that you know really well and how they approach them and live their lives, I find it really interesting.
You know, I think that strategy of, like you said, spending the 6 hours to solve whichever problem could just be solved by, you know, buying a newer device or a different device, that describes perfectly my Linux journey. of just spending time learning things that, you know, it was a random curriculum that was just thrown at me with the problems that I would encounter. Either, you know, you update Arch and today it just needs some extra attention. So you learn a thing or two.
Arch never breaks, by the way.
In the end, it never breaks. Yeah, you're right. But that, I don't know, feels like I learned so much just by being in the fire. And so these days, problems show up and I'm like, oh, yeah, I've seen that one before. And you can solve it pretty quickly. Now, is that an excuse for sticking with things like Linux that break occasionally where other systems might not break? I don't know, but it feels good to me.
Only in certain situations. You know, the Linux has come an unbelievably long way in the last 20 years. It's the de facto standard on the server. I just think on the desktop, it's never quite broken through because things like macOS and Windows have just maintained that mind share amongst normals. What I found really interesting recently is I was doing some work with a less technical person, and I found it really interesting walking them through the steps of creating an SSH key and cloning a repo from GitHub and all this stuff. And they were like, oh, so this is why everybody talks about Tailscale being really easy, because it solves all of these problems for me. And I'm like, yes, this is why. And until you've lived that pain for a while, you can't appreciate just how nice it is sometimes to just have something work first time.
And Chris, I think you might also agree that learning how things work under the, you know, under the covers is also really valuable, even if you are using abstracted tools in your everyday, just because when things do pop up, then you have those, that ability to solve things. You've impressed me many times on like just bringing knowledge out of your system administration like background that I didn't even know existed. And so I would imagine that stuff, if you've gone through the pain of it, just sits with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, the fundamentals. I think too, there's different types of, there's a long-term pragmatism to sticking with Linux, I have found, because I'll drift sometimes on my desktop for my workstation, and inevitably I always end up back on Linux because like the platform will do something that I don't like on, like, say, Mac. And it feels like I have no say or no control or no real purview over even what's coming down the pipeline. So there's sort of like a, like, I don't want to have the rug pulled out from underneath me kind of pragmatism to it, but it is tricky at times. It's sort of the same mentality I have around self-hosting. It's like sometimes I can, you know, if it goes out, it's my own fault. It's like I can cause data loss. It does take more work to maintain it and back it up and keep it all up to date. But the practical side of me, which is the sort of the more the longer term looking at it, it's like if I can maintain that infrastructure, then that entire time I'm not building dependency on whatever cloud service I replaced, and all of that's private and all that activity remains private. So it's just I think it's a similar kind of mindset.
That ownership, both good and bad, is both a feature and a bug, if you ask me.
Now, you boys have both gotten into car repairs yourselves recently. Do you see parallels there? Because I sure do, of taking that kind of repair ownership into your own hands. Yeah, you're more responsible, but you know exactly what's happening.
Yeah, and you can break it.
Yeah, when my turbo boost pipe blew off because I forgot to tighten the clamp. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was
yeah.
My fault. So.
And you knew instantly what you had done.
I did my oil change the other day, and of course I was checking the air filter, and I got a call. And I answered it, and I never tightened the air filter box back down. And I drove home, and I thought, well, I'll check the oil level after it cooled for, you know, 15 minutes, because now I want to see what it was after I drove for a bit. And I open up the hood, and I can see all the screws are up on the air box, and I'm like, oh, boy, I'm glad. Jeez, God, I'm glad I don't think anything went wrong.
Oh, you'd know. You'd know. So Axiom Joyride writes in, I've got a couple of Raspberry Pis that I use with Recalbox for retro gaming. Recalbox includes Kodi, which I've not quite made use of yet. I am not set up for network streaming my media, and for beginning simplicity, I figured I would just attach some storage and just have an all-in-one setup for gaming all my old shows and movies until I'm ready to expand. I have started importing my media with MakeMKV. Could you maybe give me some insight or share some resources on how to organize and set up the metadata, like titles, episode names, etc.?
That's a great question. When I lived with Kodi, my experience was you live and die on how you've named everything, because if you nail that, then all of like the metadata detection stuff works. And so Axiom, I'll put two links in the notes on their kind of wiki notes on naming things correctly. And then two links for some programs that I recommend. One is called Media Elk or Elch, which is kind of more directly connected to Kodi, which will go through and manage all of your media. And then one is Tiny Media Manager. This is the one I've used before. And it will go through and scan everything and help you make everything named correctly. But then additionally, it'll pull down the metadata for like artwork, cast information, all the NFOs that Kodi can just read automatically, and then it doesn't have to do that legwork. And it'll help you identify files that the system can't recognize, because if Tiny Media Manager can't recognize it, Kodi probably can't either.
Couple of picks from me. FileBot is another one. This is paid software. It's $6 for a one-year license, or you can buy a $48 perpetual license, lifetime universal license. It works across Windows, macOS, Synology, Linux, Unraid, Docker, all that stuff. It's actually a really nice interface. It will match your media against online databases, so it will rename the files as well as generate the info files, like Chris was saying. Another option is you could use something like Sonar or Radar. You don't have to use those tools for piracy. You can use those tools as a legitimate way of organizing your media collection and renaming things with certain naming conventions and all the rest of it.
And also that would show you what's missing really easily too. So you could complete the collection. That's a great idea, Alex.
Now, I'm not in the business of condoning collecting Linux ISOs, but should you wish to use that functionality, it's rather easily available once you have gotten on the R train.
And, you know, I think your idea of keeping it simple, putting it all in one box and using Kodi, I think that's totally doable. Set yourself up SSH, because some of these things like Radar is a web app. You can get it running. The Linux Server IO fleet has a really easy to use Docker Compose. You can get started within a few minutes.
Now, Recalbox was new to both me and Chris, but the retro gaming angle is a really interesting one. I don't wonder whether you could do something almost like the Steam Deck and have like a 10-foot interface, like big picture mode for Steam, and then use something like this Recalbox thing to hook into all the ROMs and stuff you want to play as your retro gaming box too. I know that Kodi has a bunch of plugins for retro gaming, like RetroArch type stuff as well. So like anything in the media space, there are 20 different ways to do everything.
I'm kind of fascinated why someone would choose Kodi and not something like Jellyfin these days. Every time I go back to Kodi, it just feels like it's from another era.
It's the client server model. So with Jellyfin, you've got to have the server instance running, which is doing all the indexing and the collating of the media and all that kind of stuff. And then you can run the client in a web browser or an actual application that you install on the box that you're using. And sometimes, you know, with Kodi, it's nice that you can just fire that thing up and point at a network share and it will just do the thing. You don't have to do any scanning, you don't have to do any indexing. So typically when Jellyfin or Plex fails for me, I will fall back to Kodi. That's when I typically use it the most. And if Kodi can't play it, then I know something's up.
Yeah, that's my move too, Alex. That's like my exact move. I would though kind of say, I'm kind of with Brent though. If you're willing, you could look at the Jellyfin Docker container. It is a nice functionality. And then it just does all the metadata analysis for you and it gives you a good UI. And even if you're just playing it on the same local box, because Kodi is a whole lot of everything, right? Kodi's going to try to give you the weather. Kodi's going to want you to be able to pick themes. You're going to be able to install these plugins. It's also going to try to, like Alex said, it's going to offer you to be able to play the games. And maybe you don't want that. Maybe you want something that just focuses on media.
Some people enjoy pain, though, you know?
Yeah. Well, and Kodi is solid. I don't mean to, you know, I mean, there's still a great place for it. So, heck, I just recommended Brent should set it up on that laptop.
Yeah, you did.
Joshua wrote in. He's got a new place, guys.
That's cool.
Congratulations, Joshua. He says, and he's just getting going with Home Assistant and his automations, but he's been getting overwhelmed. He'd love it if you could give him a quick refresher and a couple of sentences on the following. ESP Home, Tasmota, and should he get into Matter versus other standards?
Okay, well, ESP Home is a way of creating firmware for embedded style ESP devices, which are tiny little $5 circuit boards with a Wi-Fi radio and some GPIO pins. why they're useful is because in the old days, you used to have to write the code yourself in an Arduino editor and actually handle things like software libraries and memory management and actually understand what was going on. With ESP Home, you write a few lines of YAML and all of that is abstracted away from you by a bunch of very clever magic that ESP Home does. Once you press compile, it spits out a binary file. You flash that file onto the ESP device and you're good to go.
Yeah, and they can work on your Wi-Fi, or there's even ones now that have Ethernet. But the thing is, too, the ecosystem of devices that you connect to these ESP boards is just incredible. I was just browsing it before the show. I mean, any kind of sensor you could possibly ever think of, you can wire to an ESP. And when you put ESP Home on there, it's really easy to work with systems like Home Assistant or other things that just use local standards.
Yeah, it really is just a question of cost. You know, the amount of utility you can get out of $10 for, you know, a $5 temperature sensor and a $5 circuit board that has a Wi-Fi radio in it. You know, you think how much a commercially available temperature and humidity sensor is. At minimum, that's what, $20, $25? And that's going to be on Zigbee, so you need some kind of controller. The nice thing about these is they're on Wi-Fi, so you don't need any extra kit either.
Yeah. All right. So where might I use ESP Home versus Tasmota?
Well, you could, I mean, they're both largely interchangeable, but the caveat there is that Tasmota is pre-compiled and designed to run on a bunch of specific devices, whereas ESP Home is just a lot more flexible.
Both great. And both fantastic for those of us who like to self-host. As far as jumping into Matter over other standards, I mean, like Alex said earlier in the show, if you can find a Matter device and you got a Matter radio, go for it. Otherwise, I'd probably skew towards Zigbee, Z-Wave, and then Wi-Fi. The ESP devices are pretty solid on Wi-Fi, and I just have a dedicated IoT 2.4 gigahertz, which I think is something people should consider.
I think I've got about 40 in this house.
Yeah.
And they never fall off the Wi-Fi. I mean, I've got 3 UniFi access points in the building. So I've got some pretty strong, pretty good Wi-Fi, a dedicated 2.4 gig, IoT, SSID, all that stuff. And they are just flawless reliable. You know, what's interesting is the Shelly devices as well are essentially just ESP boards.
Yeah.
Baked into a proprietary firmware that they let you flash Tasmota or ESP Home onto as well. You know, so they are very, very flexible devices.
I think most Wi-Fi IoT devices get a bad rep, but they've been pretty good. I've got a bunch here in the studio. I've had one since day one that drops off, and I think it's just like a bad one. The rest are all super solid. Good luck. Keep us posted, Josh, on how it goes. Give us an update.
Now, while we're talking about media centers, Jellyfin this week put out a call for developers. We need contributors, they say, fresh ideas and fresh blood to help bring the project forward and move past our current funk into something more.
Our current funk. Yeah, you know, they noted in the blog post that the reaction to the recent Plex news that we responded to, a lot of people said, we'll switch to Jellyfin. And they said a very common response they would then see is, well, I don't like Jellyfin because of XYZ. And I think the devs just sort of went like, look at all these reasons people don't like Jellyfin. Like, they want to essentially rally the troops and start working on those things. Good on them, I say. Now, we got some boosts into the show, as we always do. Thank you, everybody who boosts in and supports the show. And our baller this week is Coffee, Bacon, and Linux with 52,476 sats using Podverse. He says, so another win for Tailscale. I've been running Nextcloud on my Tailscale network for a while, but this last week I had a need to give someone access to some files. And for various reasons, I couldn't add them to my Tail network, my Tailscale network. So I got a cheap VPS installed, and I put Tailscale on there, then a little Nginx reverse proxy. I pointed the proxy to my Nextcloud over the Tailscale network, a few settings tweaks, and bingo!
That piece of feedback was basically written for me and Brent, wasn't it? Thank you, Coffee, Bacon, and Linux. That's a nice story.
Such ninja moves, too. Very impressive.
That is very something similar we did for a live segment on Linux Unplugged, where we had a box on the LAN that we wanted to give the audience access to live, but we didn't want to expose the public IP of the studio. So we did that same setup on a Linode. Thank you for letting us know, Coffee. Galactic Starfish comes in with 52,087 sats. Howdy, I've been wanting to boost in for a while, and frankly all the JB shows, for a few months. Somehow, though, I lost my MoonPay email address. I couldn't top off, but figured it out with Cash App, and now I'm here with Victory. I recently purchased an M1 Mac Mini, as per Chris's musing, to finally get into self-hosting. I slapped NixOS on it, and I have just been having a blast. Tailscale, Nextcloud, and eventually some Home Assistant shall reside upon this box. All good stuff. I'm looking forward to the meetups this October. Thanks for the wonderful show.
Other apps are available, you know, people.
I know, you're noticing a theme.
Tailscale, Nextcloud, the MVPs of self-hosting.
It really is like, because you build on top of it, right? Like Tailscale obviously provides the networking, but once you have Nextcloud, you realize there's so many different options out there that will use Nextcloud as a back end. There really are so many.
Yeah, I see them almost as like catalysts or enablers to so many other possibilities. So they're like the foundation, and then you just build a bunch of stuff on top of those technologies.
I mean, for my, you know, because I'm an Android user now, for my Pizel 7.
Really? I had not. Yeah. You haven't mentioned it.
Yeah, you know, I'm using Android now. I've essentially replicated iCloud from photo to storage to notes to location tracking. It's pretty great. And it's all running on top of the cloud of Next. And Galactic, I am looking forward to seeing you at the meetup. That's going to be awesome. And thank you for the support. John A. is back with 20,000 sats using Castomatic. And he says, I ordered a Home Assistant Yellow and I got mine in a month. You know, John, I think it was folks that ordered it when the CM4 was available. Or if they ordered it without a CM4 and supplied their own, like a lot of folks did. They got theirs. But then what happened not too long after the Yellow launched is the Raspberry Pi folks just couldn't ship. And that's sort of outside of Home Assistant and Nebuchadnezzar's control. Kind of unfortunate timing. And I think it forced a lot of us self-hosters to go look at other alternatives. Nord came in with 10,000 sats using Castomatic. Okay, so it'd be fantastic to hear more about ZHA versus Z2M. I myself have Z2M running in an LXC container with MQTT and another one in Home Assistant and yet another. It's working great. But I've actually considered the opposite move of Alex, and I thought maybe I'd migrate to a central solution using ZHA, which is the stuff built into Home Assistant for Zigbee. Using the Sonoff something coordinator in Atena, I could maybe have it all working great. He also likes the IKEA TradFi. He thinks it works better, I suppose. Now, Alex, you kind of changed your mind, actually. You're thinking about going with ZHA, too, so...
Well, I mean, I've been on ZHA for a while now, and with the Conbi that I've had... As we've documented in the show, it's not reliable enough for me to depend on. And, you know, like I said, I put up some of those IKEA blinds before I went away, the smart blinds. And Catherine messaged me on a couple of evenings saying, blinds aren't working. And I'm like, yeah, okay. So you have to walk up to them and actually push the button. And she's like, I'm too short. Well, get a stool. You know, so it's just not an ideal situation. So I really do need to find a way to make those blinds in particular now really more reliable than they have been. So that's why I've ordered the Tubes ZB device, which you'll hear about more next episode. But this might be a good opportunity for me, even though it says it's not supported on the piece of paper I got, to try out Zigbee Z2M, Zigbee to MQTT.
Well, they talk about it on the website as like it's supported.
Yeah. So I guess I'll try a few things out. And I've got some Zigbee bulbs here and a couple of IKEA buttons and an Arcara button that I ordered as well that just came in a couple of days ago. So I'm trying a whole bunch of different suggestions from the audience, and you'll hear more about it soon.
Nice. Okay, and our last one this week comes in from KMOG, I think, using the podcast index. And we'd put the ask out there for some financial tools. He says, I have one. For zero-based budgeting, I've settled on Buckets. It's not perfect, but it's replaced my Windows Adobe Air YNA4B executable. I was having to run through Wine. Oh, that's good. He says, I'm using Nextcloud to sync it across my machines. It's not open source, but the developer seems to be reasonable so far, kind of similar to the Reaper model, which is our recording tool. I have a Nix expression that just packages it up as an app image for me. I've been using StartMail, and I haven't had any issues. I've compared the different providers. I didn't want an office suite, and I already have Nextcloud, so StartMail is affordable. It's simple. And it's privacy respecting. It allows custom domains and unlimited aliases. I also have another Nix expression to configure postfix for outgoing email. So it's the closest to having a self-hosted email without having to deal with hosting the actual email.
Okay. StartMail. I am going to investigate that this week. That looks absolutely amazing.
Good tips.
Can I ask a Nextcloud question?
Are you allowed to ask those? I thought you were supposed to be the purveyor of all Nextcloud knowledge now.
Yeah, we're supposed to ask you Nextcloud questions. Yeah.
Okay, well, I have, I don't know, you can call this feedback or an ask for feedback. In my investigations, and from what we heard, a ton of people are running Nextcloud, which is amazing. Thank you. Now, I run it with a Snap, and that's because I did it like 5 years ago, and it's just been kind of going and going and going, and I haven't had to do anything with it. So let's hope it stays that way.
Or you're scared to touch it, you mean?
I mean, a little bit of A, a little bit of B, you know.
Is it staying current? Is it self-updating?
Yeah, it's on Hub 6 and everything. What I appreciate about the Snap team who's looking after it is they kind of test things before sending it out. So they don't just send the newest version out the day it goes out. They actually, you know, put some effort into trialing it and making sure nothing breaks and stuff, which is always good. I mean, the developers of Nextcloud and the community there do their best. But yes, you know, things happen. But the question I have, I guess, starting with you boys, but also for the audience, is how are you running your Nextcloud? Because there's so many ways to do it, and I find it confusing, and I'm supposed to know things. So what I'm seeing, at least if you want to do it through containers, is there's an official Nextcloud Docker image, but it's a little confusing because that's a community project and not actually an official Nextcloud image. So that is confusing, even if you know what you're talking about. There's the Nextcloud all-in-one container, which some people love, some people find a little bit challenging and confusing or not flexible enough if you're coming more from a professional background. There is linuxserver.io, that way to run things, you know. So I'm seeing millions of downloads on linuxserver.io, 500 million plus on the quote-unquote official image. The Nextcloud all-in-one has like far less than that, I think at like 5 million or something like that. But there are also a bunch of other different ways to run Nextcloud. And I've just been curious. I thought I knew how people were running it, and I actually realized I don't know. So I would love to hear. And if you find this whole container situation confusing, then I'd like to hear that as well. Or if you think it's just fine, maybe it's just me.
It's a great question. I use the Linux server IO image, just always have historically. I thought maybe next time I do a go around, I might try just doing it all through Nix. But myself, I'm using the Linux server IO image.
And why from there? And why not just, I don't know?
Well, because it's been really straightforward. And I kind of always have used those because they do this. Something that people didn't think about early on was user management properly and setting the user IDs correctly. And Linux server IO has been really great at that. And it's pretty straightforward, but I think it uses SQLite, which not great with Nextcloud.
We're designed, I think, to just make the initial setup as simple as possible, which, similar to the Snap, will eventually bite you in the ass. The idea behind making things easy to get going with compromises is it's a laudable goal, but in the long run, if you're going to rely on something like Nextcloud to do critical stuff, putting a proper database like a MariaDB or a MySQL or something behind it is just common sense, the way to go. And we've seen listener Jeff have endless issues with his Nextcloud for reasons I don't fully understand.
Cosmic rays, I think.
Poor Jeff.
But to answer your question, Brent, on air at least, I just use the official Nextcloud image. I just use Nextcloud tag 26, if I look in my GitHub right now.
So like the Docker official image, which is the community run. Yeah. And that's been working for you.
Yep, pretty much flawlessly since I lived in London. I just migrated.
Does that ship with SQLite?
I don't know officially, but I have been using a MySQL database with that Nextcloud instance. I've migrated across two different VPSs, and now finally it lives in my basement in North Carolina. Actually, no, it started life under my stairs in London. Then I put it on a DigitalOcean VPS. Then I moved it to Linode, and then I moved it across.
That's so great.
To Raleigh. Yeah, same container.
I forgot there's also the wonderful folks at Nextcloud Pi. They do a Pi-specific image, and they kind of do a similar approach of, like, trying to make it easy to...
Oh, Brent, the rabbit hole goes deep because there's all those, like...
TrueNAS. You can do the TrueNAS, like, with their...
There's those NAS devices. There's those platforms like Umbral and things like that that'll have all their own app stores. Yeah, let us know. It'd be great to hear from the audience on how they have their setup and any nuances, and if you've had database issues, and if you've been using Snap, all that. Thank you, everybody who did boost in. We did not get to all of them on the air, but we'll link to the Boost Barn in the show notes. They will be enshrined in our doc. We had 12 total boosters. We stacked 285,549 sats. Thank you very much. You can boost in with a new podcast app at podcastapps.com. If you want to keep your app, well, there's a lot of exciting stuff going on, but if you want to keep your app, just use Albi. GetAlbi.com, top it off, and then boost from the index. We have links in the notes.
Now, I've made the decision not to travel to Seattle for Linux Fest, or the weekend formerly known as Linux Fest. Just too much going on with work and travel and all that kind of boring stuff, and I'd like to see my family for a bit. So maybe I'll see you in the spring.
Ooh, yes.
Until then, you can go to selfhosted.show/contact for all the different ways to get in touch with us, and you can find me on my new links website at alex.ktz.me.
And there's still lots of meetups happening Friday and Saturday. Those details are on the Linux Fest Northwest meetup, not ours. And that's at meetup.com/Linux Fest Northwest.
And Alex, I think you're going to be at All Things Open, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's coming up in, well, just a couple of weeks now, I think. Yeah, so if you're in the Raleigh area, stop by, say hello. I'll be at the Tailscale booth.
Well, that's exciting. Brentley, thank you for joining us. If you'd like to hear more Brent, catch him on Linux Unplugged every single week. Thanks, Brent.
Yeah, anytime.
So thanks for listening, everybody. That was selfhosted.show/107. You have an LED light display in the shitter?
I want your advice on one.
Okay, yeah, well, go on then. That sounds like a crappy topic.
The thing is, so I've added power to Jupes's bathroom. That's not actually something, except for like a DC fan and a DC light. We added an AC outlet to the bathroom. And so I want to now add kind of a nice low-key LED light display.
Is it GFCI, Chris? Did you follow the rules?
Of course. Actually, it's an extension cord, Brent.
But is it taped to the wall?
No. We've got a plate. But I've had like these NanoLeaf displays that are beautiful. And of course, they've crapped out on me after a year in the controller. You can't buy itself. I've got LiFix light bars that are awesome, but proprietary and connected to their cloud service. I want something I can basically run off of like an ESP, but I don't want just like an LED light strip that I put around the ceiling, because anything I can do is just tacky looking. I want something that's a nice display that could be like put on the wall, not big, just something nice that could be like affixed to the wall and provide light and not have to buy like a $300 pre-made kit that burns out in a year and requires their crappy app and service.
You might be looking for some of these 3D printed NanoLeaf projects, maybe.
Oh.
You can 3D print these like triangles and then put little contacts, like pogo pins, in each corner. And they'll connect to each other and make these like light panels that are infinitely configurable.
Are they using like WLED or something? Like,
yeah, can do.
Okay. That I would be very much into. Where do you find these things? Because I was trolling eBay. I was trolling Etsy. And what I was seeing was a bunch of people just repackaging the commercial stuff.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to pay for it. Like, so the idea would be buy a 3D printer or put a call out to the audience who have 3D printers.
Uh-huh.
And then do a little bit of soldering when Jeff's there, maybe, and you'll be good to go.
You know, I really, at some point, am going to just break down and get a 3D printer, because I have a feeling I would have been using it for years for this kind of stuff.
You know, you should just ask Alex for a hand-me-down, and it gives him an excuse to upgrade.
Yeah, Alex, you let me know when you're ready to upgrade.
I have been thinking. So I've been a Prusa diehard for many, many years, as you probably know. I really value their open source mission, and I really, you know, just from a principled standpoint, love supporting that kind of thing. But there's a company called Bamboo Labs who have ripped off a bunch of open source technology and are now, you know, vaguely closed source way have this X1 carbon printer, which everybody that I've spoken to that's had a Prusa and has upgraded to this thing says that something that used to take 5 or 6 hours to print on a Prusa takes 90 minutes on this Bamboo printer.
Wow, this thing looks like a consumer product too. It's really getting there.
It's really nice, but it's $1,500. So it's twice the price of a Prusa. It's not open source, but it's really fast. And
can you use Linux with it?
What do you mean?
Like, do you connect it directly to a machine? Is it running like a little Linux machine on there that you connect to over the net? Like,
I don't actually know. I think it is on the network somehow, because there's like slicer software that is a fork of Prusa Slicer, which itself was a fork of Slick 3R or whatever you called it back in the day.
They have their Bamboo Handy app too that works with
it. Yeah. Yeah, like you say, it's much more of a product than the Prusa experience, which is still, for all, you know, all the polish it has, is still a little bit of a Maker Lab, Hacker Lab type feel to it, which, you know, for some people like me, is exactly what you want, but
May I ask what makes it faster? Like, what is actually going on to reduce those speeds?
Well, there's a bunch of stuff that Bamboo Labs have done called input shaping, which is a way of predicting what the resonance of the frame is going to be at certain movements, and then in their firmware, calibrating for that, so they can actually move the head faster by anticipating what the movement's going to be and like break at the perfect moment to slow it down without impacting print quality.
Okay, that's cool.
So they can just move the head a lot faster than a Prusa. The other thing that it does compared to a bed slinging printer, which is what the Prusa is, it moves it, so the Prusa moves its print bed backwards and forwards, as well as the X and Y axis, moving left and right and up and down on the Z axis. The Bamboo Labs one is what's called a Core XY printer, where the bed stays fixed and the head moves forwards and back and left and right, and then the bed moves down away from the print head. So the print head isn't moving up and down all the time. So all the retractions, there's a bunch of really clever reasons why it's so much faster. But the input shaping is the big one.
Physics. So impressive.
You know, I was just looking it up and I noticed there's a bit of a debate online that kind of has a shared theme with what we discussed in the show today. A lot of people online are saying that if you go, now this doesn't apply to you, Alex, but they say like you go buy the Bamboo, if you're a newbie like me, you've never owned a 3D printer, it doesn't teach you the fundamentals of like dealing with why maybe a head clogged and how you clean it. You just kind of, you're getting the prepackaged thing, so you're not learning the very basics first. You're kind of getting an iPhone instead of learning how to build a PC.
And with 3D printing, it's a bit of pretty unique situation. You know, you're dealing with turning a physical thing, a spool of plastic, into another physical thing. And there are mechanical things that will and do go wrong in that process. But, you know, the same is true of your car. And in certain situations, that's fine. You just take it to a mechanic to fix it. The difference is there aren't really very many 3D print mechanics around, so just one of those things. You've got to be prepared to roll your sleeves up if you get into 3D printing, I think.